persecute one group of immigrants in exchange of protecting others. And I think that's something that we need to work to ensure that we can have a solution for many of these young people and ensure that we can contribute to the country we call home.
Cesar Vargas, I want to thank you for being with us, co-director of the Dream Action Coalition, New York State's first openly undocumented attorney. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Amel Ahmed, and Nat Needham. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars, and Karl Marxer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Veg Fest, October 14th and 15th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Portland Veg Fest celebrates plant-based living with special guest speaker, running legend Scott Urich, along with free food samples, health and nutrition speakers, chef demonstrations, fitness stage workouts, restaurants, films, and activities for kids and teens. Again, that's the Portland Veg Fest, Saturday, October 14th and Sunday, October 15th at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you for your pause, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
We want to thank everyone who joined or renewed your membership during our fall membership drive here at KBOO. We came very close to our $105,000 goal. We were within $10,000 of it. If you have not donated, please do so. Go to the website kboo.fm/give. Thanks again for supporting the best radio station on earth, KBOO.
Thank you for your pause, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
It is 5:01, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, at today's Real Sanctuary rally at the ICE Detention Center, a five-person lockdown is taking place in front of a bus, preventing the vehicle from transporting undocumented immigrant passengers.
Just days after putting away equipment used in fighting the Eagle Creek fire, Multnomah County has taken it back out and is sending a strike team of five fire engines and their crews to Northern California to assist in the North Bay fires.
President Trump continues his feud with North Korea, sending B-1 bombers flying over the Korean Peninsula.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 11th, 2017. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael thinks Trump may be the most American president ever.
America started as a lie, discovered by Columbus, and has continued that way. The Revolution was about keeping revenue here. The Constitution was made to protect the rich from the rest of us. Slavery was just a fraction of the Civil War's economic incentive. Gulf of Tonkin, 9/11, the war on Iraq. Democracy has nothing to do with it. Follow the money, the oil, the power. We now have a president who is everything we've tried to deny about our nation. America is as delusional and power-mad as Trump, ready to say anything, do anything, to be on top. I'm fearful because of my country's history, but in love with most of its people, its remaining natural splendors. I fight for my friends, for the future, for the idea of democracy, hoping, against all I know and see, that someday all Americans will be free. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
This week, the state of Oregon made its first disbursement of cannabis sales taxes since legal sales of recreational marijuana began in 2015. After reimbursing the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's administrative expenses, the $85 million pot of revenue will be distributed as follows. 40% goes to the state school fund, 35% to state and local law enforcement, 20% to mental health and addiction treatment programs, and 5% will go to the Oregon Health Authority. The amount a local jurisdiction receives depends on its population, any local add-on taxes, the number of licenses in the community, and the land area used for cannabis production. Areas that don't allow cannabis-related businesses do not receive any local funds.
U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos visited McMinnville High School today, and protesters from Northwest Oregon were outside to greet her. Oregon Education Association President C. John Larson said Betsy DeVos's anti-public education policies are not welcome in Oregon's classrooms. DeVos did not give a speech, but toured the school and sat in on some classes.
There's no rest for the weary. Just days after putting away equipment used in fighting the Eagle Creek fire, Multnomah County has taken it back out and is sending a strike team of five fire engines and their crews to Northern California to assist in the North Bay fires. The team will join up with trucks from other Oregon cities on their way south. Four fire engines and crews from the Oregon Department of Forestry arrived in Northern California yesterday. California's Governor Brown has declared a fire emergency in Napa, Sonoma, and Yuba counties, where over 21 people have been killed, nearly 600 people unaccounted for, and over 2,000 homes and businesses have been burned down. Over 7,000 acres have been burned so far.
Zoom Management, parent of Zoom Care, the Portland-based chain of on-demand healthcare clinics, admitted to violating Oregon's insurance code by filing false financial statements and failing to maintain adequate reserves. To settle the lawsuit brought against it by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Zoom agreed to pay $285,000 in civil penalties. Zoom also agreed to pay $2.1 million to cover its members' claims and liabilities. The state began pursuing Zoom Care in April when Zoom's health plan was ordered into rehabilitation by the Marion County Circuit Court. While Zoom Care will no longer be writing new insurance policies, existing Zoom Health members will remain covered through the end of the year.
At today's Real Sanctuary rally at the ICE Detention Center, a lockdown is taking place in front of a bus, preventing that vehicle from transporting undocumented immigrant passengers. Earlier today, KBOO reporter Kyle Kureji spoke with organizer Carrie Coe about the rally.
Okay, so tell me what's going on at the ICE Center. I hear there's a five-person lockdown?
Yeah, so today at the ICE Detention Center on McAdam, five organizers from Portland area are locked down, barricading themselves in front of an ICE detention bus. They are preventing the bus from leaving and taking undocumented immigrants, members of our community, to the detention center in Tacoma, Washington.
Okay, and how long has this been going on?
It just started. It has been going on for probably like 10 minutes. It's just started.
Can you tell me more about the people who are on the bus?
Yeah, so we don't know exactly who is on the bus because ICE and the GEO group, who own and operate the bus, and the private prison that holds undocumented immigrants are not very forthcoming with information. But we know that when the bus comes in to the detention center here and then leaves, it's going back up to Tacoma and it has people on it. So whoever is in that bus, whether it's one person or many people, we believe that that's one too many. And we are here to advocate for the end of deportations and for Portland to be a real sanctuary city. So we plan to block the bus for as long as we can.
Okay, and can you tell me about the people who are in the lockdown? Are they with any sort of activist organization, or do they have their own virtues they're going for?
Yeah, so the folks who are organizing this event today and who are locked down are part of the End Deportations Now Collaboration, which is a group of activists and organizers from the Portland area who are all U.S. citizens and have their documentation and are taking action because of the increased risks to undocumented members of our community, and the continued deportation, despite the fact that Portland and Multnomah County are supposed to be sanctuary cities. So they are putting their bodies on the line to stop deportations today and to advocate for the end of all deportations. One of the reasons why we're out here today is because deportations are an ineffective, expensive, and violent method of harming our communities. So no matter what, we don't think that people should be deported. And we think that it does not do anything to create safe, welcoming, secure communities. So one of the reasons why we're out here is because Portland and Multnomah County portend to be a sanctuary community. But in fact, we can't really be a sanctuary community while ICE is operating in our communities, because ICE, law enforcement, the police, they're using threats, they're using intimidation, and they are continuing to be a problem for our community. We know that just a few weeks ago, ICE officials were harassing documented people in Hillsboro, right? This is not just about undocumented people. Deportations and the harassment of law enforcement affects us all. And that's why we're out here today.
Mm-hmm. And this was part of the larger rally that was going on today at the ICE Center.
Yeah, exactly. It is. So there's about 50 people down here supporting the five folks who are locked down. And we hope that more people come. We would encourage you to follow us with the hashtag NoICePDX to see what's going on down here. And we encourage people to come on down.
Okay. And Carrie, is there anything you want to add about the situation, lockdown, rally, how Portland should function more as a sanctuary city? Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I think in order for Portland to be a true sanctuary city, we need ICE out of Portland. We need ICE out of Oregon. And what that means is that they should not have an office here. They should not be operating in our public buildings. And we should be having all deportations. That's what having a sanctuary city looks like, in addition to having the situation in our community where people can meet their basic needs. So, you know, that's part of advocating for. We want Portland to be a real sanctuary city. We want to see our elected officials follow through on that commitment.
That was KBOO reporter Kyle Qureshi speaking with Kari Coe at the Real Sanctuary Rally. You can find footage and updates on the event by searching for the hashtag NoICePDX.
And now it's time for today's National Native News Report from Native Voice One.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Felony and misdemeanor charges have been dropped against a Pueblo woman who's a leader in efforts to abolish an annual fiesta in New Mexico, which celebrates a Spanish conquistador. The Santa Fe, New Mexican reports prosecutors dropped charges against Jennifer Marley Tuesday, who was to appear in court on Wednesday. She's accused of hitting two police officers with a sign during a protest last month at the Entrada, which is a reenactment of Spanish conquest. Marley is a lead organizer of the grassroots group The Red Nation and is a student at the University of New Mexico. She has been a high-profile figure in working to end the event, which many say represents genocide of Native Americans. In an open letter after her arrest, Marley wrote the movement is not just about the Entrada, but about protecting Native land, livelihood, and sacred sites. The Red Nation's work includes addressing a number of indigenous issues. Protecting the Grand Canyon is important to a number of tribes, and there's often a divide between indigenous people, government agencies, and local landowners on its management. Utah Public Radio's Julie Kelso recently spoke with members of the Hualapai tribe about the importance of including traditional knowledge.
As you float down the Colorado River from Glen Canyon Dam to Lake Mead, River Right, the north side of the river, is owned and managed by the National Park Service, and River Left is managed by several groups, including the Hualapai and Havasupai Indian Nations. Kavoka Jackson, a member of the Hualapai tribe and graduate student at the University of Las Vegas, is currently researching methods to remove invasive plants while reestablishing native plants that are also culturally important.
To me, the Colorado River is really sacred, and it's held really close in my heart because on my reservation, we grew up along the Colorado River.
Tribes and federal agencies have collaborated to manage natural and cultural resources within the canyon. But cultural and institutional barriers can be much harder to cross than borders drawn on a map.
I think there's a big gap between traditional knowledge, the traditional ecological knowledge that tribes hold, versus the Western science, and they don't communicate, but I think they could hugely benefit each other.
Since Glen Canyon's construction, an annual monitoring trip is conducted by each tribe in the region to assess archaeological and botanical resources. Ethnobotanist for the tribe, Carrie Cannon, describes the significance of these trips.
To me, the goal of the trip oftentimes is more about the sharing of traditional ecological knowledge. Tribal people have their language and their ideologies and their own unique way of looking at the world and the names that they have for plants. They tell a story.
Collaborations between the federal government, state agencies, ecologists, and tribes had a rough start, but through many heated arguments and discussions, tribal knowledge has been included in the management of Grand Canyon resources. I'm Julie Kelso.
A university on the Northern Plains will use a gift to help Native students access higher education. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
An anonymous donor is pledging just over $4 million to South Dakota State University. The gift is designed to support a school initiative for tribal members. SDSU officials say most of the funds will go to build a new American Indian Student Center. South Dakota State President Barry Dunn says the building will cover about 15,000 square feet on the south edge of the campus in Brookings, South Dakota. $100,000 of the pledge is earmarked for scholarships for students from South Dakota's Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota tribe. The efforts are part of SDSU's Wakini Initiative with the goal of increasing student numbers from the state's nine tribes. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Two men were arrested late Monday by Spokane police on charges of assault and malicious harassment. Jason Cooper, 32, and his friend Donald Pritchard, 36, repeatedly used racial slurs towards a victim named Norris Cooley, a black man living in the neighborhood. Cooley was clearing out his garage late Sunday evening when the two suspects approached him and yelled slurs at him before shooting a handgun into his home where people were staying. Many witnesses reported hearing the gunshots and the racial slurs while in their own homes, some ducking at the sound of gunfire. A woman in Cooley's home also ducked down to the sound of gunshots, later realizing that a bullet hole in the wall lined up perfectly to where she had previously been sitting, indicating that she would have been shot if she had not moved. Cooley did not respond to the attacker's slurs and hid in the house before the shots were fired.
Immigrants may need to be careful what they like on Facebook these days. The Department of Homeland Security issued a notice in the Federal Register that it will monitor the social media activity of anyone with an immigration file. That includes permanent residents and naturalized citizens. Faiz Shakir, National Political Director of the ACLU, decried the move as an example of the Trump administration's anti-immigrant agenda, stating that it would have a chilling effect on the free speech that's expressed every day on social media. However, Homeland Security says that the notice does not represent a new policy and that collecting social media in immigration files is nothing new. Homeland Security has collected social media activity since 2002 and has been under pressure from Congress to expand its surveillance since the 2015 San Bernardino shooting, where one of the attackers had been advocating for violent jihad on social media in advance of the attack. Whether monitoring social media will help prevent terrorism remains to be seen. For now, many are left wondering whether an anti-Trump tweet might get someone's visa taken away and whether that prospect will cause immigrants to censor what they say.
It's 5:17, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The self-described geniuses of Wall Street are being stupid again. In 2007, their stupid schemes and frauds crashed our economy, destroying middle-class jobs, wealth, and opportunities. Far from being punished, however, the scofflaws were bailed out by their Washington enablers. So the moral lesson they learned was clear. Stupid pays. Go stupid! Sure enough, here they come again. Rather than investing America's capital in real businesses to generate grassroots jobs and shared prosperity, Wall Street is siphoning billions of investment dollars into speculative nonsense, such as bundles of high-risk subprime auto loans. It works like this. Car dealers, eager to goose up sales, hawk new vehicles to lower-income people, offering quick loan approval even to those with poor credit ratings. Banks, eager to hook more people on monthly car payments, okay these subprime car loans without verifying the buyer's ability to pay. Then, a Wall Street bank's investment house buys up thousands of these iffy individual loans, bundles them into multimillion-dollar debt securities, and sells them to wealthy global speculators. Last year alone, banks sold $26 billion worth of these explosive bundles of car loans. This is a gaseous repeat of Wall Street's subprime mortgage bubble that burst a decade ago. The scam generates easy money at the start for speculators and banksters, but as more and more low-income buyers are unable to make their car payments, defaults build up and the whole financial bubble pops. This is Jim Hightower saying, wasting America's much-needed investment capital on a scheme that intentionally puts people in cars they can't afford with loans they can't repay is not only stupid, but immoral, and is killing our economy. Why are we letting elite Wall Street loan sharks do this to us?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's Right to Survive. Then at 7, it's Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather is a chance of showers and thunderstorms with a low of 46. Today in history, Saturday Night Live debuted in 1975, starring Chevy Chase, John Belushi, Gilda Radner, Dan Aykroyd, Garrett Morris, and Jane Curtin. Quote of the day is from John Belushi in Animal House. Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no.
Can you talk about the environment without mentioning climate change, carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases, or renewable energy? Well, you can if you're Scott Pruitt and the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA's recently released four-year strategic plan contains none of those phrases. In the EPA's 2014 plan under President Obama, the phrase climate change appeared more than 40 times. Also, the Trump administration has this week moved to scrap the Clean Power Plan, which called for phasing out coal-powered electricity generation, and has suggested that federal subsidies for wind and solar energy should be eliminated.
And now for your daily climate change and environmental report with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot are major Jewish holidays. But Rabbi Ruhi Sophia Motzkin Rubinstein says much of the meaning behind these festivals has been forgotten.
I think a lot of Jews have a sense of these holidays that is very divorced from their ancient agricultural context, but these were all harvest festivals, and they all involved praying for rain and praying for the climate to be maintained in the regular, hoped-for ways throughout the year, and giving thanks for the abundance of the earth.
At Temple Beth Israel in Oregon, Rubinstein uses these holidays as an opportunity to talk about climate change. As droughts and extreme storms become more common, praying for good weather takes on a new significance. To emphasize the importance of climate action, Rubinstein's temple hosts youth trainings and movie screenings about global warming. It also has a green team that participates in regional climate activism.
We have to make sure that we are stewarding this gift of being humans on Earth well, because if we don't, no one's going to fix it for us.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now more for climate. We have a set of climate change reports from the Green News Report.
This is my neighborhood in flames. Completely in flames.
Fast-moving, deadly wildfires sweep across Northern California wine country.
Harvey, Irma, and Maria could make 2017 one of the top years for weather disasters.
2017 on pace to shatter weather disaster record. 2017 also breaks a record for Atlantic hurricanes, and it ain't over yet. Plus,
the White House argues that the Obama-era regulations have been burdensome to the economy and American workers.
Trump's EPA moves to repeal Obama's landmark clean power plan.
Great timing. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You know, regulatory power should not be used by any regulatory body to pick winners and losers.
Unless the winners are the fossil fuel industry, who get $20 billion in tax breaks and subsidies every year. Am I right, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I think many of us were breathing a sigh of relief after Hurricane Nate began to break up, only to see these horrific, devastating fires now out here in Northern California.
Yes, as we go to air, in Northern California's wine country, at least 10 people are now confirmed dead. 50 are missing in extremely fast-moving, heat- and wind-driven wildfires that have forced the evacuations of more than 20,000 people, including two hospitals. California's fire chief announced Monday that at least 1,500 structures have been destroyed. He said that was a conservative estimate. The wine country fires are among 14 large wildfires now burning in California.
And they are just exploding across Northern California and some down here in Southern California, wiping out homes overnight. Just horrendous.
And as you mentioned, Hurricane Nate made landfall on the Mississippi coast over the weekend as a Category 1 after killing at least 28 people in Central America. 2017 is now the most active Atlantic hurricane season in the modern record. For the first time since the 1890s, the Atlantic Basin has generated 8 consecutive storms that developed into hurricanes. And hurricane season isn't over until November 30th. In Puerto Rico, Governor Ricardo Rossello has asked Congress for additional financial assistance, warning that Hurricane Maria's catastrophic damage has crashed Puerto Rico's economy, deepening the humanitarian crisis. Distribution of aid remains the biggest hurdle 3 weeks after the storm, but there is some positive news. Governor Rossello confirmed he is in talks with Tesla CEO Elon Musk over Musk's proposal to rebuild Puerto Rico's electric grid as a proof of concept for a large-scale renewable energy system with battery storage.
With clean, renewable energy across the entire island, wouldn't that be fantastic? So I'm sure the Trump administration will get in the way and put a stop to that.
On Friday, NOAA announced that 2017 is on track to be a record year for billion-dollar weather disasters. Since January, the U.S. has already experienced 15 extreme weather disasters costing more than $1 billion each. That matches the number of disasters in 2011 and is second only to 2016. On average, there used to be only 5 or 6.
The year ain't over yet.
But even as the U.S. faces a record year for extreme weather, the Trump administration is rolling back another major tool for fighting climate change, taking the first formal step to repeal President Obama's landmark Clean Power Plan. That's the first ever regulations to limit the carbon emissions from U.S. power plants that cause dangerous global warming. The Clean Power Plan is key to reducing the U.S. contribution to climate change and is crucial to the U.S. meeting its international pledge to reduce emissions under the U.N. Paris Climate Accord, and it also convinced China to join as well. But in remarks in Kentucky Cold Country on Monday, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt claimed the EPA overstepped its authority.
You know, regulatory power should not be used by any regulatory body to pick winners and losers. The past administration was unapologetic. They were using every bit of power, every bit of authority to use the EPA to pick winners and losers in how we generate electricity in this country.
Pruitt's claim is wildly contradictory. It comes on the heels of a proposal by the Department of Energy to intervene in electricity markets with new subsidies to prop up the ailing coal and nuclear industries, which have proven unable to compete against cheaper wind, solar, and natural gas. And most states are already on track to meet the plan's emissions targets at a lower cost than previously projected. The fossil fuel industry praised Pruitt's move. States and environmental groups have vowed to use every tool to challenge the repeal in court. Now, the repeal is only the first step in a long process that could drag on for years. Crucial time lost in the fight against climate change.
Crucial time lost, but apparently no hypocrisy lost. not by this administration. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Now for a look on this day in labor history with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day acclaimed photojournalist Dorothea Lange died. She is celebrated for her work documenting the Great Depression for the Farm Security Bureau. Lange's photos captured images of migrant workers, sharecroppers, and the rural poor. Her iconic photo, Migrant Mother, is probably her most well-known image. It depicts a despondent Dust Bowl mother surrounded by her hungry children. Lange was born in Hoboken, New Jersey in 1895. She suffered the effects of polio as a child, which left her with a permanent limp. She studied photography at Columbia University in New York and eventually settled in the Bay Area. When the Great Depression hit, she began photographing labor strikes, bread lines in soup kitchens, the homeless, and unemployed. The Resettlement Administration hired her soon after. Nowadays, we can access images from around the world at a moment's notice that broaden our understanding of current events. But until the 1930s, few Americans could access media that adequately depicted the desperate social conditions engulfing the nation. Federal programs that funded projects like Lange's brought Depression-era images into the public eye. Americans soon realized their suffering wasn't caused by personal failure, that millions across the country were experiencing destitution brought on by broader economic forces. During World War II, Lange worked for the War Relocation Authority, where she documented forced evacuation and internment of Japanese Americans. Her images, especially of Manzanar, were withheld from the public until after the war and were accessible to the public through the National Archives. After the war, she taught at San Francisco's Art Institute and co-founded the magazine Aperture. She has been heralded as an innovator and has influenced generations of documentary photography. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. PFAC, the part-time faculty union representing hundreds of members at Columbia College Chicago, is in a do-or-die collective bargaining struggle. PFAC has filed an unfair labor practices charge against the college. PFAC Communications Director Rosalind Cummings Yates.
We are in a battle to retain our rights as part-time faculty, to retain respect in our voices, which have pretty much been ignored over the last year.
Cummings Yates says that Columbia College Chicago is bargaining with PFAC, but not truly in good faith.
There are active sessions. Good faith. Well, there's a lot of stalling and a lot of back and forth. I can't come out and say that it's been totally in bad faith, but I wouldn't call it good faith. They are trying to decimate the union. They do not want a union. They do not want to have to guarantee a certain amount of pay. They do not want to have to guarantee a certain assignment of classes.
Cummings Yates says here is what PFAC is fighting for at Columbia College Chicago.
We are fighting for a quality education. We are fighting for fair wages and respect for part-time faculty. We are fighting for the rights of students to be able to have a real education that's not centered around profits and corporatization and academic freedom. That's what we're fighting for.
U.S., Mexican, and Canadian civil society groups, including labor, are delivering hundreds of thousands of ISDS out of NAFTA petitions. The AFL-CIO, Teamsters, CWA, Machinists Union, UE, Good Jobs Nation, and Our Revolution are among the groups demanding ISDS be taken out of NAFTA. Some members of Congress and other civil society groups want it eliminated, too. They say ISDS gives immense power to corporations that hurt workers. The groups say that ISDS makes it less risky and expensive for corporations to outsource jobs and empowers them to attack domestic policies that protect public health and the environment by going before tribunals of three corporate lawyers who can order unlimited compensation be paid to the corporations by taxpayers. ISDS stands for Investor State Dispute Settlement. WIN is America's multimedia news voice for workers. Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
President Trump continues his feud with North Korea, sending B-1 bombers flying over the Korean Peninsula. The bombers were part of a joint nighttime exercise with the Japan Air Self-Defense Force and the Republic of Korea's Air Force, which also included missile drills over the waters east and west of the peninsula. The exercise took place just hours after Trump met with his top military advisors to discuss, quote, a range of options to respond to any form of North Korean aggression. A new Associated Press poll shows that two-thirds of Americans believe Trump's comments about the situation with North Korea have made it worse. Meanwhile, reports are circulating that Trump plans to visit the Korean Demilitarized Zone during his upcoming trip to South Korea. In April, Vice President Mike Pence made an unannounced trip to that DMZ.
Mohammed Bayezid, a Syrian filmmaker, survived an assassination attempt in Istanbul yesterday. Bayezid was stabbed in the chest while on his way to meet a supposed investor after the assailant asked Bayezid about his name. His ongoing project is a film based on a true story about an inmate in the infamous Tadmor prison located in Palmyra, Syria. The Tadmor prison is known for its brutal human rights abuses and containment of political prisoners against the Assad regime. The prison was captured and destroyed by ISIS in 2015. Bayezid's wife and filmmaking partner, Sama Safi Bayezid, commented on the situation by saying, "When we chose this life, we knew what it meant because we aren't from places like America where we can express our opinions."
Russian President Vladimir Putin was presented today with a puppy as a belated gift from the leader of Turkmenistan. That's according to CNN, whose coverage depicted a delighted Putin holding and nuzzling the albino puppy named, we kid you not, Vernie or Faithful in Russian. Of his close intellectual and emotional connection with dogs, Putin said once, quote, "As far as bad moods go, I have them like any other person, but in those cases, I try to consult with my other dog, Coney. She gives me good advice." The gift is not without precedent. Putin has previously been gifted other dogs, including the aforementioned Coney, who was a gift from Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu. Japan, too, has previously gifted Putin with a dog in thanks for Russian help after the 2011 earthquake, that time an Akita called Yume. Of all things to gift an elections rigging leader, a dog, really? Apparently Putin is a dog lover, which might explain his eagerness to cozy up with Donald Trump, who, for his part, seems to quite enjoy his unofficial posting as the Russian president's fuzzy orange lapdog. Here's hoping the citizens of both East and West soon come to their senses and see fit to throw these two leaders into the doghouse.
84% of Ugandans are subsistence farmers. They are resisting both rampant land grabbing and General Yoweri Museveni's attempt to rule for life. KPFA's Ann Garrison spoke with Phil Wilmot, an American-born activist who now lives in rural Uganda.
84% of the population of Uganda are rural subsistence farmers. They are resisting both rampant land grabbing and U.S. ally General Yoweri Museveni's attempt to rule for life. I spoke to Phil Wilmot, an American-born activist who now lives in rural Uganda. Phil, could you tell us how you came to live in northern Uganda?
Basically, I, in 2009, started studying at Uganda Christian University, and I fell in love with another student there who comes from northern Uganda. We got married and settled in Lira District, so it didn't really have anything to do with the political reality. But living here and being activists, we could see what was going on with a dictator that has stayed in power for 31 years. We could see the police brutality in our communities. We could see the regressive tax regime. We could see all the manifestations of totalitarianism in our daily lives. Excessive taxes in the markets, extreme poverty, not because there's no land or natural resources or Ugandans are lazy or anything like that. No, it's just because one man essentially wants to exploit all the wealth of the country for himself.
Okay, tell us about that man.
Yoweri Museveni came to power in 1986, basically through the gun, and has stayed in power through the gun. And he's a big ally to the Western world, to the global north, especially the United States, which gives him hundreds of millions of dollars every year in military and security support, which he then uses to evict people from their land, to even war in other countries like Congo, South Sudan, Somalia. He'll basically do the bidding of the global north and fight the war on terror.
And what about the land grabbing?
One of the manifestations of dictatorship in northern Uganda, and not only northern Uganda, all across Uganda and in much of Africa, is land grabbing. So basically what happens is a multinational company or foreign investor or even a huge domestic investor will have their eye on a piece of land or maybe a mine and will work with the state to evict people from that area forcefully. So we started Solidarity Uganda by resisting such evictions and land grabs. We started in a district called Amuru, which borders the River Nile in northern Uganda. And of course, this is an oil-rich area and very fertile as well. So over the course of several years, we worked with this community to chase away land grabbers and multinational companies, one being Madvani Sugarcane Corporation, but also a number of oil companies who usually operate under shell companies that do research and surveying of land. Or they'll contract Uganda Wildlife Authority, ironically enough, to survey land for oil drilling or something of the kind. So this is a very common thing. We've worked with a number of communities across Uganda that have been able to protect their land from land grabbers.
Okay, now, what does this rural population share in common with the opposition MPs who got into a brawl with security forces in parliament last week?
There are two main issues happening in the country. On one hand, there are physical brawls in parliament because Museveni is trying to entrench his stay in power by scrapping presidential age limits from the constitution. So this has caused uprisings all across the country, including rural areas, and it's encouraging to see Ugandans stand up for themselves. Then the other big issue happening right now is a series of land reforms that are very neoliberal. They are basically trying to say that no displaced people should be compensated until the land is actually grabbed, among other things. And so we're trying to nationalize the struggle rather than working on one-off cases of land grabs to unite people across the region to stand up together against the land reforms and against land grabbing, because there is no rule of law here. So no matter what the law says, you still might have the land grabs taking place, even if you have the best laws in place.
And that was Phil Wilmot of Northern Uganda. His accounts of organizing there can be read on the websites of Waging Nonviolence and Voices for Creative Nonviolence. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA and Afrobeat Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
For those who complain about our lack of sports coverage, here's poet Dan Raphael.
Having attacked American football, it might be time for Trump to take on what the rest of the world calls football, soccer. Last night, the U.S. men's team lost to Trinidad and Tobago, islands so small they'd be hard to find if plopped into L.A., so won't be competing for the World Cup in Russia. Trump would say the game is rigged against us, but the truth is America's best athletes are doing what all Americans are supposed to do, go where the money is. Maybe enough parents won't want their children's brains to be damaged by repeated concussions and slide them into soccer instead of football, but some parents will still see football as their son's only chance of wealth and maybe an education. We need to change so much more than sports. We need more innovators, more activists, more lovers of humanity, and a lot fewer gladiators. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Isabel Cochran, and Jeff Hood. Our producer is Kyle Qureshi. Our engineer is David Kesters. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelzelz Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. And you can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Voices from the Edge, guest host Lisa Loving takes your calls. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to author Celeste Ng about her new novel, Little Fires Everywhere, a short story set in suburban 1990s America that deals with questions of race, the comfort of privilege, and parenting. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Hello and welcome to News from the Boo. Indeed, it is that time of the week again. It is Wednesday, I believe, October the 11th. And this is your weekly update about what is going on in and around KBOO. And I'm your host, Delphine Crescenzo, and I'm very happy to be joined today by Becky Myers.
Hi, everybody.
KBOO's Development Director.
Hey.
I would love to start, you know, I'm sure lots of folks know you and maybe they are aware of who you are as a person, but I'm not sure that everybody does. So I was wondering if start by you sharing a little bit about yourself first, and then also your role as KBOO, as
Development Director. Yeah. So I came to KBOO in, I believe, 2013 in April or March when I first came back to the United States. I had been living abroad. And I came to a volunteer orientation. I wanted to volunteer while I was here for the only month I was supposed to be here. And then I accidentally didn't get on my plane.
It's been 5 years.
Yeah. And then it's been 5 years and now I'm here. And in February of 2015, I had the honor of joining the KBOO staff as development director. And I have been, you know, here since, making radio and making the fundraising work